Apollo 10.
Go ahead, 10, over.
The other day when he tracked it, the first day in lunar orbit. So I guess that's about it as far as the tracking's concerned. It's going very well, at least on the first trip.
Okay, please wait for the mic, and let's do the questions first to Jack Schmidt so that he can get back to the control center, and then we'll go to the flight director. Okay, all of these for Jack Schmidt.
Yeah.
What is a control point, what is F1, and what is the landmark 130 at landing site number 2?
Okay, all these landmarks are small craters. And what the object of the exercise is, or the technique of the exercise is to put the reticle of the sextant centered in the crater and have it centered for 5 specific marks. And these marks then are correlated with the time of mark and the gimbal angles of the spacecraft, IMU angles. And control points are called that because they're on the far side, and they're, one of their main functions is to help control the strip photography that's taken. They have a navigational function, is they do represent a point in space that we can track, predict where it ought to be the next time, and then compare the predicted results with the actual results. F1 is essentially a control point. Its nomenclature is different because we hope to use this particular area for some visual altitude checks during limb descent on the G mission, on the Apollo 11 mission, excuse me.
Dick Lyons, second row.
Well, it's a little early to evaluate this completely. From the comments of the crew, which have been abundant, it sounds as if we're going to be able to revise our estimates on the relative proportions of volcanism versus impact in various parts of the moon. Now, I'm not going to say, and in fact, I don't believe, impact mechanics or impact processes are the major processes shaping the sculpture of the lunar surface. But superimposed on this, or preceding it in some cases, has been, for some time we've felt and fairly strongly that volcanism was an important process. And our whole effort, limited scientific effort on Apollo 8 and Apollo 10 has been, or one of the major parts of it has been, to help define the relative proportions of volcanism versus impact. As I said the other night, or as I probably didn't say the other night, this all relates to the degree to which the moon has fractionated as a planet, to the degree it is differentiated as a planet. And it, as you probably heard before, it does represent a part of Earth's history that we have no chance of seeing live, so to speak, on the Earth now. The Earth's weathering process, the atmosphere, hydrosphere, has destroyed our chance to observe this part of the evolution of our planet. And the moon does present this opportunity to us.
First row here.
Yeah, Jack. In the propagation of where the landmark will be sighted 2 revolutions later, the actual tracking is used as a judgment for how good the propagation is. Is that?
Well, let me see if I can quickly on the Apollo 11 mission. You combine the lunar orbit determination of the spacecraft at MISFIN that the Manned Spaceflight Network gives you from tracking with the landmark tracking data, which gives you the position of the landing site relative to that orbit. But because of the nature of the checkouts of the limb, the power-up, the preparations for descent burn, it takes you 2 revolutions to get to where you can use that data and actually land the limb. And so you have to do it on 1 revolution, and you can't use it, but you can't update it either for 2 revolutions. And so the propagation is that far. Now, on Apollo 8, Apollo 10, what we're trying to do is run this exercise of tracking, coming up with a targeting position for the landing site, and then comparing it 2 revs later with what we do again. See, we can measure it 2 revs later on this mission.
Right. The actual measurement would involve the marking. In other words, when John locked in on was it 130 after 2 go rounds, and we'll get a disparity there, which will be our margin of accuracy in propagating two orbits ahead.
That's right. That's right.
When will we have this?
You'll predict what it is two revs ahead, and then two revs later, you'll measure it.
Right.
And this gives you a measure of your capability to do that.
And do we know yet from this mission how close we are on the propagation?
No, we're still on the second rev of tracking. And we won't know completely, because this is something that we'll be doing with this data, and it's a test operation now on 10, and the math physics branch in particular will be playing with this information for the next few weeks, coming up with what is the final procedure mathematically and operationally to work for the 11 mission. That was one of the big reasons for flying this mission.
Will this change the R2 model for...
I am not qualified to say that, whether it will or not. I suspect it won't. It would be very difficult to change at this time, and I doubt if they'll come up with any good reason to change.
Thank you.
The main thing they're doing is evaluating that model.
Ed DeLong.
Jack, if this had been a landing mission, and if 130 were the landing site, how close could the astronauts have come to it based on the performance of R2 to date and their tracking to date?
Well, I can't say. We haven't looked at the data yet, or I haven't. I don't know of anybody that has to say today how much we could improve or degrade what we predicted we would be able to do before the mission. We just haven't gotten that far with the use of the data. We're just getting it now. It doesn't happen that fast.
Okay, about one more question for Jack. John?
Let's make it a two-parter then. Did the mishap at the time of staging interfere at all with the observations to be made on the surface during that pass? And the other part is, do you... let's answer that one first.
Well, no. Well, I any of us can answer that. There were no observations scheduled for that period of time. And I wouldn't use the term mishap particularly. I think it's been over-exaggerated, the difficulty of that particular...
What about the problem with the cameras, where we found a lot of profanity involved in the mishaps with the magazines? It seemed that at that point that they felt they were missing some pretty good opportunities to take some pretty fine photography.
It's my impression from following the live transmissions that very little of the prime photography was missed that we wanted prior to landing site 2 on that low pass. It appeared to me that the camera, from their comments both during that period of time and after, that they were getting lots of pictures up until about the point that they were over Site 2. And I think that that's where Tom mentioned quietly that the camera was not working. If it went that far, we got the major low-level photography we wanted, which is oblique photography into that site, to help Neil recognize exactly where he's headed.
I was thinking more in terms of the scientific photography or the scientific benefit to be wrung out as a side effect than of the landmark tracking photography, which was the prime objective here.
Well, the two are inseparable. We got most of the photography up to Site 2. After that, and that's what we had hoped to get, because after that, the main object was to get into a phasing situation.
And
we lost a few. I'm sure we lost a lot of pictures we would like to have had. But I'm saying we got most of the ones we had planned to get prior to Site 2.
Throughout the early part of the first pass, all of the transcript, time and time again, it was indicated that that Stafford and Cernan were absolutely convinced that what they were seeing was vulcanism. It came up time and time again.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if they're right in most of the cases of what they saw. These fellows have, in the past, have been exposed to a fair amount of volcanic geology on earlier field trips. Now, these have not been, they've hadn't had a refresher course for quite a while, but they know probably better than most people in the room, and better than most laymen, what features are volcanic and what aren't, what are good candidates for being volcanic and what are not good candidates. Also, in the process of our training at the Cape, both for the operational things of recognizing where you are at any given time and identifying landmarks, you can't help but talk about what are the characteristics of these features that, if you see them close up, would help you identify volcanic features versus impact, one of which, and Tom has mentioned this on at least on one of the tape dumps, the appearance of flows on some of these cones. And flow is a fairly easy thing to identify if you see it fairly close up. And I suspect very strongly that most of what they are seeing will turn out to be volcanic in origin. Most of what they're calling out. But see, the impact features are very well-known, common, and well-accepted. What they're seeing are new things that were controversial, and these controversial things are what they're calling out as largely appearing to them as being volcanic.
Okay, front row here, and then we'll let Jack clear out.
Could you give us some information on the film loads, number of magazines, approximate number of frames that they have on board the spacecraft? And do they have any color film, too, as well?
That's handled in your press kit. It's in the press kit, and also the query desk has copies of the TV and photo operations plan. It has all the number of frames, number of magazines, everything.
Why don't we take one more back there?
Is there any report from the astronauts on the observation of Surveyor 5 and Surveyor 6?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the last
part. Is there any report from the astronauts on the observation of Surveyor 5 and Surveyor 6?
No, we haven't heard from them yet. They're definitely, this is something they're very interested in trying to see. Apparently they did not see it during the low pass. They did not mention it, though, as I heard. Surveyor 5, you may recall, is down in a crater, so that's not surprising.
Is there any possibility in the future that the astronauts can see the Surveyor 6 or 5?
Well, I think there's an excellent possibility because of the high contrast of this spacecraft with the fairly dark lunar background and the possibility of reflections. Now, John may well, one of these times when he has a spare minute, turn the sextant over there and try to see it, but that's going to depend on how well rested they feel, whether he'll do that or not. That's something we talked about a little bit, and he said, well, maybe if I have time, we'll do it, but that's not a flight planned item.
Okay, Jack, do you want to clear out now?
Can you make it quick?
Can you offer any explanation of what the color these men are seeing? They're talking about light browns and light brown grays. Now, in Apollo 8, they mentioned only gray or... Does this mean anything to you geologically?
Well, it means that about the range of colors you can expect to see on Earth when you don't, if you took away the atmosphere and the oxygen in particular. What makes the Earth very colorful largely are compounds of oxygen. And the moon obviously doesn't have as much oxygen readily available on the surface anyway. And these are the light shades, very subtle shades of color that you'd expect, browns and grays and whites, and I wouldn't be surprised if you had a very subtle comparative color chart, you'd probably pull out a few more colors. But it's the Earth gets its color from the oxygen, the oxide compounds. And it doesn't surprise us. One of the most interesting things is that they're seeing some very dark boulders around some of these bright craters, which is sort of very interesting. I wouldn't have expected that. That was a surprise. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure what it means. We'll have to think about that one. It may mean that these craters are going through a variety of different kinds of materials, and you're seeing parts of these thrown up at different places around the rims of these impact craters. See, where they're talking about those are around the impact craters. Moke, for example, and that crater that's named after some other Schmidt. Not me. I'm going to have to run.
Thanks a lot, Jack. Okay, ECOM and Flight Director, questions? That's it.
For the ECOM, number one, could we have the spelling of your name? And number two, what are the mission rules about the fuel cells in terms of, you know, not just this, but if something happens to another one?
Okay, first of all, my last name is spelled L-I-E. B-E-R-G-O-T. For the life of me right now, I can't recall the details of the specific rules, but if we do lose a single fuel cell, we will continue the mission.
Follow up on that here.
Okay, Ed.
Does the fact that you have to pull this one fuel cell off do anything to the TV passes in terms of, you know, the power you have available?
No.
Does not.
No, because the two fuel cells, once they are presented with a greater load to supply, will do just that, given about 2 hours. And that's what we saw.
Would you and or Pete amplify a little bit on the possibility or probability, rather, that one man may have to spend the night babysitting with this?
Well, there's not too much we can add to that until they spend some more time seeing how we can manage that one fuel cell. On the way over here, we were discussing that particular question, and Cy already has some very good ideas about how to prevent having to keep somebody awake all night, and I'm sure we'll work something out, some way of getting a temperature high and then letting it cool down all night, or the other end, getting it low and letting it heat up all night. I'm sure some technique like that can be worked out.
Okay, back here.
Could Mr. Frank explain exactly what happened when the LAM was undocked from the command module? They gave some rather weird explanation of it, that it shot off like a rock or something like that. And it's not clear why it did this. So, and the astronauts themselves seem to be rather surprised by the behavior of the LAM.
Wasn't that covered yesterday?
I think that was pretty well covered in yesterday's debriefing. And to go back to an old saw, that didn't happen on our shift.
I can very briefly tell you what it was. They were slightly out of configuration for using the control systems. The way they were trying to do that, and the auxiliary or abort guidance system, when it was activated, tried to move the limb into such an attitude that the rendezvous radar could start tracking the CSE. I'm sorry. Okay.
Jettisoning the limb.
Excuse me. Yes. Okay. Right. Okay. That's still somewhat unexplained, except that the pressure in the tunnel there, when the separation was made, would cause the velocity to be imparted to the limb to help kick it off there at a faster speed than it was expected. And that is about all I can say about that at this point.
Front row here.
On the TEI tomorrow morning, what is the planned delta V duration, and why is it occurring 12 minutes later than originally scheduled?
Okay, the 12 minutes later, that's a guess right now, but everything we've done in lunar orbit has been 12 minutes behind the flight plan, and that's because we got there 12 minutes later than we expected pre-flight. And that all went back to because we changed our mid-course correction situation. The delta V should be almost exactly what's in the flight plan. See if I can find it here. Okay, I'm sure it's not much different from the nominal, 3,622 feet a second delta V. About 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
John Roberts.
Can you explain briefly to me why it is that it takes only 54 hours to get back and 72 hours out?
I can't hear you.
Can you explain briefly why it is that it takes only 54 hours to get back and 72 hours out?
I'm not sure how brief it will be. Going out, there's a very rigid set of constraints that we're trying to stay within. That has to do with this free return characteristic of the trajectory. And that is one of the features of the free return trajectory, is that you take whatever flight time is associated with the trajectory that goes around the moon and comes back. It would be rather involved to prove that you have no control over the flight time going to the moon, and in that you have to take what it requires. Coming back, you don't have that constraint. You're just limited only by how much fuel you've got to speed yourself up, or how much heat shield you've got to absorb the entry heating. That's what it amounts to, but if we weren't constrained to free return trajectories, we could do the same thing going to the moon. We could get there faster if that was...
Tell us what the difference in the distance the spacecraft actually travels on the way out versus the way back in.
I don't think so. That's a kind of, you mean like
curved line distance
that it
right,
follows?
As opposed to the straighter line on the way in.
No, I wouldn't be able to get that handily at all.
Anything we get would be kind of an estimate, I imagine, because you don't you track at a given point in time straight out to the spacecraft? Just, I guess someone could plot it graphically and get a rough idea. Third row.
Two questions regarding the fuel cell situation. One, does this resemble the problem that cropped up in, I guess, Apollo 7 with fuel cells? And two, you did mention that this fuel cell will be brought online for mid-courses, I assume also TEI. Is that right?
Okay. Now, this problem doesn't resemble in any way the problems associated with prior fuel cells in flight. Those problems are associated with a bypass valve in one of the coolant systems. This, you could say, is kind of associated in that we have lost the capability to circulate the coolant by losing the pumps. And we have apparently lost the entire pump package. It's two pumps, one for water glycol, the other one for the hydrogen. And essentially also we have lost the capability to condense water out of the fuel cell. But we can manage that by purging hydrogen through the fuel cell overboard to remove the water. So we can manage that.
Okay, let's take one more question over here.
Have you more precise evaluation of the communication problems which you had yesterday?
I didn't get the question.
Would you say again, please?
Have you made any more precise evaluation of the communication problems you have yesterday with the two spacecraft and what this is involved in terms of Apollo 11?
Okay, we haven't done much scientific investigation of those problems. We have talked with the crew on a couple of occasions trying to get a little more data. We had several communication problems. We had to start off with the VHF system between the two spacecraft. And we really don't have any more data than we had yesterday, except the crew reiterating some statements that had been made. The VHF problem seemed to solve itself. Once they got the spacecraft separated, that all cleared up. They didn't do anything different to the switches or didn't reconfigure it in any way. It just started working. And we suspect that was a matter of a receiver being saturated and it just wouldn't work that close together. Now, that's only a theory, and I'm sure not saying that was what the problem was. And that's really all we know different about the VHF problem from yesterday. The one that caused some of us a lot of concern was the USB communication problem at low altitude, the first time the LEM went across the moon there at a very low altitude. And we talked with Gene Cernan again today about that. And from what he said, it was a matter of him having some trouble getting the steerable antenna locked up and tracking the Earth. And he just said, to heck with it, I think, just gave it up. They were too busy to keep fighting it. And so he switched over to Omnis and went on about their whatever else it was they were doing. He didn't want to keep working with that steerable antenna.
No performance of the Omni, was that foreseen, or was it a kind of surprise for you?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that was foreseen. We sort of were leery about getting good telemetry and communication, voice communication, with those Omni antennas. I think some of us were very disappointed in it, but there were those more responsible for the systems that did predict that sort of low performance.
Okay, one more back here. Don Wiseman.
Now that you've had a chance to look at the tracking data during the LEM's low pass, is it within your dispersions? Could you have landed safely with the limits you found on that trajectory?
I honestly can't answer that. I haven't really looked at it, and I haven't talked with anybody that has.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good job,
announcement in 1 minute.
This is Apollo Control at 124 hours, 31 minutes. There has been very little air-ground conversation during the change-of-shift news conference. The crew has been busy with the landmark tracking tasks. We'll play the tape of the conversation that has taken place and then stay up live through the remainder of this pass. We have about 44 minutes of acquisition time left.
Hello, Apollo 10, the Houston, we're sending that over.
Roger, Apollo 10 in Houston, we're doing landmark tracking and we're coming up to landmark F1.
Roger, 10, good afternoon, you guys. Wanted to congratulate you on a great day yesterday. Didn't get a chance to do it yesterday. It's a beautiful show.
Okay, thanks much, Charlie. On the ground really came through, coordinating those vehicles together. You must have a heck of a load on your shoulders tonight. The support was fantastic, and I sure appreciate it.
Well, we've had a lot of fun. Thank you much. Say again, John.
Yeah, I can feel the tension down there all the way up here.
We were a little tight at times. You guys did a great job. Let you get back to work now, Al.
Sure, Roger. Thank you, Al.
Over.
Okay. It looked okay in the telescope this time.
Okay.
That's the end of the tape, and we're live now.
Apollo 10.
Go ahead, 10, over.
I'm gonna pitch around to the 092 attitude and we'll get you some high gain then, over.
Roger, 10.
Houston, this is 10. Summary of the last four landmarks. CP1, I'm not sure, as reviewing it in my mind, whether I tracked the same CP1 on the first one as I did on the second one. CP2, I'm sure I've got the right one. F1, I'm sure is the right one. And 130, I'm sure is right.
All right, John, we copy. Maybe not sure on CP1, the rest are the same.
Yeah, and CP2 I did with a sextant. CP1 and 2 were with a sextant. F1 was with a telescope. 130 was with a sextant. And I'm going back to the telescope on CP1.
Roger.
Probably CP2.
Roger, we copy, John. Next rev, you're going to try the telescope on CP1, 2, and F1 and use the sextant on 130.
Roger, and I may not do that. Depends on whether I can identify it in the sextant or not once I get it in the scope.
Roger, we copy. How's the old eyeball holding out?
Eyeball's okay. I just keep it's a question of washout, things like that. At different inclination angles, when you're passing over it, these little things look different. Especially in that sextant where you got these two landmark line of sights sort of in competition with each other.
Roger.
130's been good, though. 130's been real good.
Roger, thanks a lot, Al. Ten, Houston, about 15 minutes before LOS, we'll have a little critique when we look at the data, and we'll talk to you a little bit more then about it. Over.
Roger.
Hello, 10, Houston. We'd like you to go to Poo and accept. We got a state vector for you. Over.
Hear and accept. Go.
Roger. And 10, if you're ready to copy now, we got a TEI 26 pad for you. SPS, GNN, NA down to noun 33, and we got 1 2 7 3 9er 2 0 0 0 noun 81 plus 31638 plus 2 vols 560 plus 0 1 6 0 1. Pitch angle is 062, and it's 2 jet ullage for 14 seconds. Over.
Charlie, we lost you. I picked you up at non-81. You'll have to go up to non-81 again.
Roger. Tim, why don't we hold off till we get the high gain, and we'll be back with you. Over.
Okay, fine.
glad, Charlie. We got your high gain now.
Roger, Dan. Do you copy now, Gene? Over.
Confirmed.
Okay, we were NA down to noun 33. Noun 33 is 127-39-2000 plus 31638 plus 00560 plus 01601 and a 062 on a pitch angle. 2 jet ullage for 14 seconds. Over.
Okay, I got TI 26 SPS GNN. Now 47 48 or NA. 33 is 127-39-2000 plus 31638 plus 00560 plus 01601. Pitch is 062 and it's 2 jets for 14 seconds.
Roger, that's a good read back, 10. And we have a Rev 26 updates for you. Tracking and the map update if you're ready to copy that now.
Okay, go ahead, Charlie.
Okay, we got the state vector in, 10. You can go back to block. Okay, the map update for Rev 26 coming at you. 125-1641. 125-2800. 126-0251. Okay, for the CP1, starting with T1. 125-3638. 125-39-38. 000-052-000. North of track 14-1241. Going to CP2 now. And starting with T1. 125-5200. 125-5342. 000-007-000. North of track 05-0443. You with me?
Still here, Charlie.
Okay, F1, T1 time. 126-0446. 126-0629. 000-330-000. North of track 101441. For, 130. Okay, T1 for 130 is 126-2553. 126-2725. 000-267-000. North 12-12-40. And that's all the pad. Standing by for your readback.
Okay, Rev 26 is 125-1641. 125-2800-1260251. CP1 is 125-3638. 125-39-38. 000052 and 000 North 141241. CP2 is 125-5200. 125-5342. 000007000 North 050443. F1 is 126-0446. 126-0629er. 000-330-000 North 101441. Is 126-2553. 126-2725-000-267-000 North 121240.
Okay, 10, that's a good read back, Gino. Out.
Okay, Charlie, from what we saw a little while ago, it looks like the sun might be shining down there.
Well, we got a big growler coming up just north of the side here. Since I came in, it might be raining out there.
Okay, that was with the naked eye from a quarter million miles away.
Your friendly geologist, Jack, just advised me that he just came in and it's summer has really arrived at Houston and it's clear and hot.
Very good.